this legislation, if enacted, could encourage others to seek federal benefits for what was purely state service.
The Defense Department stands behind President Obama's take on the Alaska Territorial Guard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 29th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the State Health Department prepares to start receiving H1N1 flu vaccine.
What we're going to be looking at over the period of the next few months is sort of like turning on a faucet.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
The Defense Department is defending the Obama administration's opposition to funding pensions for Alaska Territorial Guard members who served during World War II. Last week, the White House objected to paying the Guard's pensions on the grounds their service during the war was not active duty. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, it comes down to whom, the territory of Alaska or the nation the Guardsmen served.
Alaska's congressional delegation and lieutenant governor are fighting the White House position, but on Tuesday, Defense Department spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Lesh Melnick said the Guardsmen just don't qualify for pensions.
While members of the Alaska Territorial Guard performed very valuable service to the territory of Alaska during the war, they were not serving in a capacity under the existing law for which they could accrue time towards military retirement.
Melnick says the men were not under the direction of the Army or Air Force. The White House says for all intents and purposes, they were state employees. Melnick says serving the territory amounts to the same thing.
While these members of the Territorial Guard may not have been technically state employees, especially since at that time Alaska was a territory, not a state, neither were they members of the United States Armed Forces or of a National Guard performing duties under the law and direction of the Army for which they could earn credit for retirement in the Armed Forces.
The White House says paying the Guardsmen would establish a precedent, and Melnick agrees.
This legislation, if enacted, could encourage others to seek federal benefits for what was purely state service.
But Alaska Senator Mark Begich says that's ridiculous. The fight is over the pensions of 26 elderly men, and Begich says it's a limited situation.
As a territory, it is more connected with the federal government than anything. The fact that it's a territory, there's a limited number of individuals that would qualify, as we have identified 26 remaining individuals that qualify. I don't think there's a lot of basis to their fear.
Begich says when the Army initially brought up the problem of the Guardsmen's classification, Congress found a fix.
It wasn't in the right section of the code that relates to the Army and paying the pension. It was in the veterans benefit component. And so we had to work through that. That's the legal language that we have in this legislation, because that's what we do in Congress, is to write the laws, and it's then the job of the Army, in this case, to fulfill that obligation.
The Defense Department's Lieutenant Colonel Melnick says it's unfortunate that an error in interpreting the law led to what he calls the improper retirement credits, but he says that's no reason to justify changing existing laws. But Alaska Senators Begich and Lisa Murkowski have put language in the Defense Appropriations Bill before the Senate this week that would restore the pensions.
In a multi-billion dollar budget, and talking about committing thousands of more forces to Afghanistan, we're talking about 26 people who helped protect our country in the only state that was occupied, a portion of it was occupied by Japan. Seems outrageous that they continue to argue bureaucratic talk when they should be focused on the service of these individuals.
Begich is optimistic the Territorial Guard benefits will survive the Senate this week. He says they have the support of powerful senators like John McCain of Arizona and Carl Levin of Michigan, the top Republican and Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. Begich says a senator would have to actively fight to take the Territorial Guard provision out of the bill. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The state is reporting two more deaths related to H1N1 flu. Both were adult women in Fairbanks who had underlying medical conditions. The state has recorded five H1N1 deaths since the outbreak began. But state epidemiologist Dr. Joe McLaughlin says the virus is no more severe than typical seasonal flu. He says in a normal year, based on national statistics, the flu would cause about 80 deaths in Alaska.
it can be severe, and it can be so severe that people can die from it, just like with seasonal influenza. And by far and away, the very best way to prevent influenza infection and death is by getting vaccinated.
The state is making final plans right now on how it will distribute that vaccine as soon as it begins receiving the first batch. That could happen in early October. Laurel Wood is the Department of Health's immunization program manager. She says it will be done in the most equitable way possible.
We've been trying to look at what is the best way to make sure that we can reach all Alaskans. The reason that we haven't been able to say exactly how many doses might be going to any particular area on any particular day up until now, the reason we haven't been able to do that is because we are only now beginning to get a little more information from the federal government about what type and how many doses of a particular vaccine we might be anticipating.
Is it known yet when the first rounds of vaccine will be reaching the state?
We should be able to order a small amount of vaccine tomorrow, but you shouldn't expect to see any of that vaccine showing up anywhere in Alaska providers for a couple of weeks. What we're going to be looking at over the period of the next few months is sort of like turning on a faucet. Initially, we're going to have just a trickle of water coming through the faucet. Every week, we should be getting more and more vaccine until that little trickle becomes more of a stream of water coming out of the faucet.
When the first rounds of vaccines start coming into the state, and as you mentioned, it will be small amounts initially, how will that be distributed? How will it be decided where those doses go?
It's a little bit of a decision factor that has to go on every day when we know how much vaccine we have available, what type it is, which providers would be the best able to utilize that, and then how can we make sure that that is spread as widely as possible throughout the state.
What are the overall guidelines on who will get first doses, and when do you think that it will be generally available for folks out of those priority groups?
The priority groups to receive the initial doses of vaccine that are available would be pregnant women, children and young adults ages 6 months through 24 years of old, people with chronic health conditions who are under the age of 64, as well as healthcare workers and people who work in emergency medical services. And then our final priority group is people who are caretakers or household contacts of children who are under the age of 6 months.
Do you anticipate a vaccine shortage at any time?
Before the United States government will quit assuring that vaccine, will quit having vaccine being made, they won't make that decision until we've been assured that everyone in the United States who wishes to receive the vaccine will have the opportunity to get a dose. Initially, though, certainly as the vaccine supply begins to be distributed, there won't be enough for everyone to get the vaccine on the first day or even perhaps the first few weeks. But as we progress through the season, there will be ample vaccine for everyone.
Laurel Wood is the immunization program manager for the State Department of Health. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a small college in Barrow attracts nationwide attention.
We're able to infuse the Inupiaq culture throughout the college, not just in our curriculum, but also how we advise our students.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com.
A recent court document reveals new evidence in Alaska's longest-running corruption scandal. The motion, filed last week by a lawyer for former state representative Pete Kott, says the new details should convince the government to dismiss the case against him. Kott was released from prison in June, along with former state representative Vic Coring, after the U.S. Justice Department concluded prosecutors improperly handled evidence in their trials. The men's convictions were challenged because the same team of prosecutors handled a related case against former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens. His conviction for failing to disclose gifts from Allen was thrown out because evidence was withheld. Rich Maurer has been following the convoluted issues of the trials for the Anchorage Daily News. He says some of the new evidence gets at the credibility of the government's star witness, Bill Allen, and his vice president, Rick Smith.
About crimes he may have faced, in particular sexual abuse of minor crimes, far more victims than had come out before. And also with Rick Smith, there was assertions that, in fact, based on Rick Smith's own information that he gave to FBI agents, that, that at the time he had terrible memory issues because he was drinking so heavily, he was potentially suicidal.
And in your daily news story, you call some of the new details stunning. What specifically were you referring to?
Well, in that case, it was the information about all the alleged sexual abuse victims. There was a listed total of four specific girls under the age of 18 who Bill Allen was alleged to have sexual relations with. And then plus a fifth woman who was 19 at the time, and a prostitute who Bill Allen allegedly was involved with, and who also reported having knowledge of Bill Allen involved with sexual relationships with minors. Previously, the Daily News and other media outlets reported that Bill Allen had an affair with one woman, and later on another woman. This certainly adds to that number.
Does this new information apply to Vic Coring's case as well?
You would think so. Vic Coring's attorney has not yet filed. He asked for a delay and got authorization to delay it for another month. But certainly Bill Allen and Rick Smith were major witnesses against Vic Coring. And one of the points that that Pete Kott's attorney makes is that Bill Allen's testimony was necessary to say what the benefit was that Bill Allen got for the money. That if Bill Allen is not credible, what he says about why he was paying Pete Kott is also not credible.
So what's next for both Kott and Coring?
Well, the government has yet to respond to Pete Kott's motion. They could come back and say, no, this is not anywhere near as significant as you're alleging, and here's why. And of course, Coring has not yet filed yet. And then it's going to be up to the trial judge, John Sedgwick, to say how significant this information is, and whether, if it should have been turned over to the defense, did it result in unfair trials? And if so, what's the remedy?
Rich, how damaged would you say the government's overall corruption investigation is at this point?
Well, it's pretty significant. Certainly, no one has seen any new cases brought out really since the fiasco of the Ted Stevens case. On the other hand, there still is ongoing investigation, and if some of this can be, if some of these problems can be remedied by disclosure, and that the evidence is still strong, I don't see why necessarily eventually there won't be more cases.
Do you think other people who have been named but not indicted, like Congressman Young and Ben Stevens, are in the clear now?
No sign of that at all. The signs are that they still are potential defendants. They're not talking, so it's unclear what they know. The government's not really talking except to say that the investigation continues. So you have to think that there's still some liability.
And so what else will you be watching for in the next few months on the corruption scandal?
Well, the big news is going to be in October when Bill Allen and that Vice President Rick Smith are scheduled to be sentenced. The government could still come back and request a delay, but the judge, Sedgwick, said he would look askance on the delaying effort.
Rich Maurer is an investigative reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Wildlife managers in Canada are hoping new hunting rules will save the porcupine caribou herd from further decline. Effective immediately, hunters must report all kills, and all hunters will be restricted to bulls only. They say the interim restrictions will stay in place until the various international user groups agree on a management plan for the herd. The CBC's Vic Ishchenko reports.
The porcupine caribou herd is still the largest in the Yukon, but it's only half the size it was 20 years ago, with numbers now estimated as low as 90,000 animals. Management board member Doug Larson says without restrictions, the herd numbers could fall in half again before 2020.
We can put these measures in place now. We can prevent that. We think we can prevent that. We hope we can prevent that from happening.
The new rules will restrict all hunters to bulls only. Aboriginal hunters can still take as many as they want, but they can't kill cows anymore.
Every time a cow produces a female calf, and that female calf produces another, and you just do the math.
Surveys suggest NWT Gwich'in, Inuvialuit, and Alaskan hunters account for 80% of the 4,000 animals harvested each year. Yukon Fish and Wildlife Director Dan Lindsay says manned checkpoints on the Dempster Highway will ensure hunters report all their Yukon kills.
Our interest is really to monitor and educate people on the ground, and we're hoping that we don't have to focus on enforcement efforts. We really do hope that we can get a change of behavior, of hunter behavior.
Lindsay says violators face warning tickets or fines from $75 to $100. The new rules also limit licensed Yukon hunters to just one bull per season. Vic Ishchenko, CBC News, Whitehorse.
Biologists are currently considering the health of different Bering Sea crab stocks and how this will affect the fishing industry. This summer's stock surveys show that St. Matthew's blue crab stocks are now healthy, Opelio crab stocks are not rebuilt, and Tanner crabs are almost overfished. The St. Matthew's blue king crab fishery closed in 1999, but it may reopen this year. The biomass is considered rebuilt by federal standards. Yesterday, the Alaska Board of Fisheries removed a management regulation that would allow the fishery to reopen. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Area Management biologist Forrest Bowers says the change will not hurt the fishery.
The minimum tack was a management tool, and we have other thresholds in place that are biological conservation thresholds, and those wouldn't change. So we can eliminate the management tool, but still have those biological safeguards.
However, the Pribilof Island blue king crab fishery is still considered overfished. In a letter to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, ADF&G Acting Administrator Robert Meekum recommends possibly closing some areas around the Pribilofs to pot cod gear to reduce blue king crab bycatch. The Bering Sea snow crab stock is not considered rebuilt yet either, according to the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Fishery managers had 10 years to rebuild the stock from the low of 146 million pounds of mature male biomass in 2002. ADF&G recommends a new five-year rebuilding plan that will get the population up to necessary levels by 2013. Bowers explains that closing the fishery entirely would not rapidly speed up the rebuilding process.
Even if we had closed the fishery this year, we still wouldn't be rebuilt within 10 years. So there is going to be a sort of an interim harvest strategy used this year that will allow some harvest, but in all likelihood, it would not be as much harvest as the normal state harvest strategy would allow.
Tanner crabs are now considered almost overfished, and the North Pacific Fishery Management Council now has 2 years to develop a rebuilding plan. The total allowable catches for most of the crab fisheries will be released later this week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Barrow residents are mourning the loss of two small children who died in a drowning accident yesterday. Harold Curran is the chief administrative officer for the North Slope Borough. Curran says a report was called in at 2:43 on Monday afternoon to both the Barrow Police and Fire Department that someone may have fallen into Middle Lagoon.
That lagoon is located between Barrow and Browerville. The officers and ambulance personnel arrived and found two small children submerged in the water.
Curran says responding officers immediately began life-saving efforts on the four-year-old girls.
They were taken to Samuel Simmons Memorial Hospital by ambulance and then medevaced to Anchorage for advanced medical treatment. Both girls were declared deceased upon their arrival into Anchorage. There's no foul play suspected.
Deceased are 4-year-old Molly Konaloak and 4-year-old Gwendolyn Gordon. Curran says the lagoon is just frozen over. He says Barrow has only had freezing temperatures for the last few days. Barrow's Illisogvic College is attracting notice from college-bound students in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and even Burbank, California. What makes this two-year community college a magnet for Alaska Natives and non-Natives alike? APRN's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
The line of somber, blue-gowned graduates moves forward to receive certificates. It's a scene played out across the nation every year, but only this time, the graduates are inmates of a woman's prison in Anchorage, and their college courses are being delivered from Illisogvic College in Barrow. That kind of distance education is one way that Barrow's community college is making itself known outside the North Slope.
Illisogvic means a place to learn.
Beverly Puktatuk Greenwich is president of Illisogvic.
I think what really makes us unique is that we're able to infuse the Inupiaq culture throughout the college, not just in our curriculum, but also how we advise our students or counsel our students and how we treat one another as faculty and staff members as well. We really adhere to our Inupiaq values of respect, sharing, cooperation, love.
Illisogvic started in 1996, supported by North Slope Borough funds.
Most of our residents and our young people don't want to leave the area. There's a really strong pull by family and connection to our traditional subsistence way of life. Our young people prefer to stay on the North Slope rather than going somewhere else for their education.
Initially, it was a place to provide job training to serve the local workforce for oil field and construction jobs. A dozen years later, the college is gaining state and national recognition. Illisogvic just received a U.S. Department of Agriculture grant for infrastructure improvements so it can keep up the job training. And now the college offers more.
We have our conversational Inupiaq classes, and you know, we had so many students register for it this fall that we had to add another section.
There are courses in skin sewing and Inupiaq fine arts, too, part of the college's Inupiaq studies program. It's a unique college in many ways, and it's a college for a subsistence culture above all through its outreach, through distance education and on-location classes in North Slope villages. There's a Teachers for the Arctic program where local students can get an AA degree, then transfer out to the state university system. Greenwich says Illisogvic provides custom classes, too, in leadership and supervision and business communications for Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and all this without 1 cent of state money. President Greenwich was keynote speaker at Highland Mountain Correctional Center's graduation ceremony recently. She told the graduating inmates that it was not going to be easy, but that education is their path out. Angela Mosley is one on her way to a degree. She's earned earned 10 college credits through Ilisagvik distance courses.
They made us feel real comfortable with the whole situation. They made us feel comfortable with going out and seeking employment. We did everything in the class, even down to practice interview situations, anything like that. So I'm real comfortable, actually. The opportunity I've been given through Ilisagvik College and through the teachers here was extraordinary. And I feel like I'd probably be a fool to pass it up. So they've basically set it up a nice foundation for us to go in and do something else with ourselves. And I'm just going to go into an apprenticeship probably. And I'm already enrolled in Ilisagvik College, and I have my 10 college credits. So I have a good start. I have my foot in the door.
Mosley is one of 8 inmates to receive college credits through Ilisagvik. She'll follow others up to Barrow in time to work on an AA that will point her toward a productive future. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A growing number of Alaskan communities are reviewing their comprehensive plans. From member station KSDP in Sandpoint, Kels Hetherington has the story.
The Illusions East Borough Assembly is reviewing the comprehensive plan the borough adopted in 2005. Illusions East Borough attorney Joseph Levesque explains why.
Because the state statutes actually require that municipalities pass comprehensive plans, sometimes if citizens want to challenge a municipal action, in the past they've said, well, you can't take this action because you don't have a comprehensive plan. And we actually have cases in Alaska that are published cases that deal with that.
Dr. Nicole Gruey, a development specialist with the State of Alaska's Division of Community and Regional Affairs, the rural affairs agency charged with assisting local governments with administration, planning, and other municipal duties, says,
philosophically and theoretically, communities should be planning to set a vision for the future, and a comprehensive plan is generally a 20-year document that should be looked at every 5 years to see if it still reflects local desires and interests.
Levesque says a key reason for a comprehensive plan in Alaska is to establish zoning authority.
The way the statutes work is the boroughs generally have planning and zoning powers, but they can delegate those to the cities within the borough if the cities want to run their own planning and zoning.
A comprehensive plan is also required by some of the federal granting agencies.
Municipalities are encouraged, of course. They're mandated under state statute to have a comprehensive plan, and they're encouraged to develop one if they want to go for that grant money. In fact, they have to have it.
For those municipalities that hire consultants to draft comprehensive plans, the cost can be as much or more than $100,000. The Illusions East Borough is saving money by working internally on its comprehensive plan update. I'm Kels Hetherington, reporting in Sandpoint.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Vic Ischinko in Yukon, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Kels Hetherington in Sandpoint. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. LitSight Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love LitSight Alaska. You can discover LitSight Alaska at LITSITE.org. LitSight Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.